This is Greater LA, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. We're starting the show today with an update on the Getty Fire. That fire began near Getty Drive on the west side of the 405 in the middle of the night. Winds have been blowing it west into Brentwood and toward the Palisades. Both those neighborhoods are under mandatory evacuation now. The borders of that evacuation area are Temescal Canyon to the west, Sunset and Chautauqua Boulevards to the south, Mulholland to the north, and the 405 freeway on the eastern edge. We're going to get an update on road closures in just a moment from Cherry Glazer. There are about 10,000 structures in that area, and if you live in one of those structures, you've hopefully heeded the call and evacuated. One person who has not evacuated is KCRW reporter Benjamin Gottlieb. He's been covering the fires since early this morning. Hey, Benjamin.
Hello, Steve.
And we also are joined by Linda Connor, who's also an evacuee who had to leave or left her home early this morning, and she's on the line with us right now. Hi, Linda. All right, we're awaiting Linda right now. Benjamin, I'm going to talk to you while we wait for Linda on the phone. Benjamin, give us the latest right now. I understand more than 600 acres have burned, right?
Absolutely, and the real tragedy here is the number of homes that have burned. I've been up here in the Brentwood area since about 4:30 in the morning, and I personally saw at least five, possibly six homes that went up in smoke and burned to the ground. Fire crews really were trying to make an effort to prevent homes from burning, Steve, in this area. But remember, this is a very there's a lot of dense foliage up in this area. This is the canyon areas of Brentwood, and there's homes up here. So as the fire broke out early in the morning with those winds that were howling gusts of even 40, 50 miles per hour, it was making it very difficult to protect all of the properties here in the Brentwood area.
All right. I'm going to bring in Linda Connor, that evacuee that I was telling you about just a moment ago. Linda, are you with us?
Hi, yes, I'm here. Thank you.
How are you doing right now?
You know, we're fine. My heart goes out to everybody in Brentwood who lost their homes and, you know, had to really witness this fire coming at them late in the middle of the night. But we live in the Palisades, sort of in the village, so we got the warning to evacuate, but plenty of time. But the disparity with just pulling out onto the PCH and seeing life go on and then looking to your left and seeing smoke and knowing that people you know's homes are burning.
Well, here's here's the thing that I've got to give it to a lot of folks who worked quickly, because the fire broke out just, what, in the 1 o'clock in the morning hour.
Correct.
You know, it's like you're already fast asleep. It's Sunday night. You're thinking about the work week ahead. There haven't been any fires in there have been fires in Southern California, but they certainly haven't been in the immediate Los Angeles area. And all of a sudden you get awakened by this emergency alert.
Right. The emergency alert goes off and then it's darkening and then the neighbors call. And, you know, you sort of perk right up and you think, you know, we're safe, we're fine. We have that sort of like feeling that, you know, we're sort of untouchable, you know, we're not up by the hills. And then you look at the evacuation order and it's growing. It's going over to Brentwood and it's moving to Mandeville. Then all of a sudden you have to go. It's mandatory. So what do? You know, you wake up, you gently wake up your child and you think, oh my God, what goes in the suitcase? What goes in the car? Two dogs, your passport, you know, hopefully, like, you know, a watch my husband bought me. And unfortunately, I did forget my daughter's fish, who's away at college, which is very upsetting to her.
Yeah.
You know, what are you going to do? I'm like, he's in water.
I'll
have to deal with that when I get home.
So you have to think about what you're going to pack in these harrowed moments. You decided to take your dogs with you. Where did you wind up, by the way?
So I have wonderful neighbors who are best friends, and luckily I'm not a native of California, but they have a beach house down south, so we just sort of caravanned out of the Palisades, got out in the nick of time, because right after we left, apparently there were road closures, and it was much more difficult to, you know, there's really two main roads out of the Palisades. There's Temescal and Chautauqua, and Temescal Canyon was shut down, and it was only Chautauqua on the way out. So we sort of just, you know, threw all the kids in the car, the dogs, the few things that you can think of in the middle of the night. You look around your home and you think, it's everything, but really what's important is just getting, your family out.
It's certainly most important.
You just go, you know, in a digital age, I can recreate those photos. But, you know, and again, my heart goes out to people in Brentwood who had to leave seeing those flames. And, you know, I luckily didn't. It was in the middle of the night.
And whose structures have burned, right? I mean, we've had a few structures that have already burned. Linda, I'm going to let you go because I know you've got a lot going on.
Thank you so much.
Are you going back home, by the way?
You know, we're carefully monitoring our phones. We're all sitting around and looking, and it does look like the portion of the Palisades we live in is now been lifted. So we're just going to, again, like that could, the wind could blow the wrong way and it could go back to mandatory evacuation. So we're just going to monitor it and just pray for everybody else who, you know, are closer to those fires. That's and everybody
really,
up north as well.
Absolutely. In solidarity, always thinking of yep. the other folks who were affected by this. Yeah.
100%.
Linda Connor, Pacific Palisades Village resident who's going, hopefully going back home. And we wish you the best. Linda, thank you for your time.
My pleasure. All the best.
Benjamin Gottlieb again on the line with us right now. Benjamin, you've been covering this for the better part of the morning, and you were up early at it. What did you see when you got there earlier?
Yeah, Steve. I mean, it was really a chaotic scene early in the morning. Like you mentioned, this fire broke out at about 1:30, 2 o'clock in the morning. And when I drove up here, we're talking thick, dark, black smoke. Visibility was very, very poor. A lot of frenetic energy. But one thing I did notice was that there were not any people evacuating. By the time that I got there, the LAPD had been driving up and down these canyon roads that are up here in Brentwood. And by the way, these canyons, they're fairly deep and small, and houses line both sides of them. So they were driving up and down these roads on their microphones, telling people to get out, evacuate. I got a lot of curious looks as I was driving into this. And again, it was a serious firefight with the wind. There were airdrops from helicopter, fixed-wing aircraft were also going a little bit later in the morning as the sun started to rise. But now as we're looking outside, I mean, I'm looking at the fire right now. The fire did not end up spreading as far, at least so far, has not spread as far as they were concerned about. And it's looking like firefighters, I don't want to say they have it under control as of yet, but the fire is not nearly as dangerous as it was earlier this morning.
All right. Yeah, we have 0% containment, by the way, at this hour. And Benjamin, hang on the line for just a moment, because I also want to bring in L.A. City Councilman Mike Bonin, who's joining us. He represents much of the west side that's being affected by this fire. Councilman, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
We heard the latest, more than 600 acres, no containment as of right now. What is the latest that you're hearing? I understand that you've been going from evacuation center to evacuation center.
And the command post here are probably just a few feet from where Ben is, I guess. They just did the latest update. And what they have been aiming to do since, you know, the pre-dawn hours is draw a line at Mandeville Canyon and make sure that the fire does not hit Mandeville Canyon, which is a long, winding 5-mile road deep into the hills, and does not cross. And they have managed to do that. The combination of the ground forces and the air resources and the tech have really been pretty good in holding this thing at bay. And it looks like the winds that we're expecting to shift in about an hour or so are going to be pushing in the direction we want them to push, pushing inland. And that will allow the fire to sort of sit still and make it a little bit easier for the firefighters to put it out.
We can only hope, certainly. We've been told that there are 1,100 firefighters fighting right now. I know we've sent some firefighters to the north with the Kincade fire that exploded yeah. over the weekend in Sonoma County, near or north of San Francisco. There are a number of other fires burning in Southern California. I think of the Tick Fire and others. How yeah. stretched are the firefighting resources?
Well, we're pretty good right now. I mean, fortunately, the Palisades fire from last week is almost done with, and the time of day that this happened was as convenient as could be for LAFD to deploy from a lot of places because folks weren't assigned anywhere. There wasn't a lot going on at that time of day. We've got about 600 from LAFD here, about 500 from somewhere else. And I'll tell you, if you've never had an opportunity to see what happens in an emergency like this with different city agencies and different agencies from the region coming together, these guys are amazing. It's like a symphony. They're just so professional and so in sync. It's a sight to see.
And those firefighters really whip it into action, man. They know exactly what they're doing. They are heroes in all of our hearts and minds. So I want want to thank you, Councilman.
And their precision with which they can drop that water down and try to save homes. It's sad that we lost eight and five more got damaged, but man, they did a great job with the air ops, making sure that the rest of them were safe.
Let's hope that they can really get a handle on this when the winds, as you say, shift or in a direction to keep that not moving where we thought it was moving earlier today. Councilman Mike Bonin from the West Side District of L.A. Councilman, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
You bet. Benjamin Gottlieb. Benjamin, I want to thank you, too, for getting out there early this morning to report on what turned out to be just an explosive fire earlier, and hopefully we can get it under control.
Anytime, Steve.
All right. KCRW's Benjamin Gottlieb. And now Cherry Glazer joins me in the studio with an update on some of the road closures that we have across Greater LA. Hi, Cherry.
Hey there, Steve. Well, you know, at one point earlier today, it was a real challenge if you were trying to make your way between the West Side and the San Fernando Valley. It just felt like you couldn't get there from here because they had stretches of the East 101, the South 405, PCH all shut down due to the Getty fire and another fire that broke out. Things looking up a lot. The East 101's reopened, so is southbound PCH. But South 405 is still completely shut down between the 101 and Sunset. And if you're looking for a back route, thinking of taking Topanga, don't do it unless you live there. It is open to residents only between Mulholland and PCH.
Topanga, a popular canyon road that connects PCH to the 101. We've got the other canyon roads on the other side of the 405, such as Beverly Glen and
Laurel Canyon, Coldwater.
Coldwater, yeah. All right. KCRW's Cherry Glazer reporting for us, too. And what about, do we have any update on the Oak Fire? Because this is the one in Calabasas.
Yes, that's right. I figure if they have reopened the East 101, that means that they are starting to get a handle on it because they've been slowly providing more access to the road as the day went on. So right. I think that's a good sign.
KCRW's Cherry Glazer. Cherry, thank you.
You bet.
We appreciate it. As we move on with the program. Well, coming up, we remember 25 years ago, this year in Proposition 187. That's coming up next on Greater LA on KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. And back in time we go to 1994. Here in California, Republicans were pinning their election hopes on Proposition 187. Here's how NBC reporter George Lewis described it and the reaction as Election Day approached that year.
The initiative, which would deny schooling and other social services to illegal immigrants, sparked student protests again today in Los Angeles and in San Francisco, where marchers converged on City Hall.
Now, here's how some folks in Orange County remember it.
It was a crazy riot, and everybody was just trying to leave school, walk out, and it was just to protest to get people the rights to stay in their country. It was a scary thought.
I was just disgusted with what had happened, and I was so disappointed that we were going to kick essentially a whole class of people, a whole group of people, straight in the balls.
I was in the sixth grade, I think, right? 7 years old? Yeah, it wasn't. I guess our neighborhood seemed pretty normal, like nothing changed. I guess that's just how it was and that norm in that area.
I remember my mom had like a little Mexican flag in her car and they wrote on the window, like, go back to Mexico or something.
That's Janet Garcia, Bonnie Berger, Corrado Contreras, and Sky Rivera. Now, Prop 187 wasn't the only thing on the ballot that year. So was the name of Republican Governor Pete Wilson, who was seeking re-election. And he went all in on 187. Voters gave Wilson and the proposition the thumbs up. But federal courts gave 187 the thumbs down, ruling it was unconstitutional. In 2019, obviously, California is a different place. Gustavo Arellano writes for the LA Times, is my compadre for KCRW's Orange County Line, and he has a podcast project that he's been working on in recent weeks to remember Prop 187 and its political effects 25 years later. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
We're also joined by Matt Barreto, who's professor of political science and Chicano studies over at UCLA. He also heads up the polling firm called Latino Decisions. Welcome, Matt.
Hola, Steve.
Gustavo, I'm going to start with you. You and I have talked a lot about the changing face of Orange County. Give us an idea of what OC was like in 1994 and really the rest of California.
Well, 25 years ago, Orange County was the Orange County of renown, you know, the place where Reagan said all the good Republicans go to die, where rock solid xenophobic Republican politics ruled the day. So, of course, it was a perfect birthplace for Proposition 187. And the rest of the state actually was not the state that we have today. So the San Fernando Valley today is very multicultural, still a little bit conservative. But back then, the San Fernando Valley was really the birthplace of Proposition 13, so a hotbed for Proposition 187. So a lot of the activists who would go on to push 187 across the state came from Orange County and the San Fernando Valley.
Governor Pete Wilson was the guy who really pushed this proposition. He was running for re-election. Let's hear him on the campaign stump in 1994.
We are going to take back California for the working, tax-paying families of this state.
We're going to take back California. I mean, we've heard those words in recent years in this country. Take back sounds like something was taken away from people. Was that his argument? Is that what he was telling folks?
And it wasn't just with 187. So one of the myths that I debunk in my podcast for the Times was this idea that Pete Wilson from the start championed 187. He actually didn't officially endorse 187 till September of 94. So just about 2 months before the election. However, he had been pounding on this drum that illegal immigration was ruining California as far back as 1991. And so this is something that he just kept talking about again and again and again. And then, of course, once his reelection campaign starts and he's way behind Kathleen Brown, his Democratic opponent in the polls, that's when he really seizes on illegal immigration. That's when he released a very notorious commercial basically insinuating that there is an invasion of vaguely Latin people coming across the southwestern border to, yeah, take away California from whatever he said, taxpaying real Californians.
They keep coming. 2 million illegal immigrants in California. The federal government won't stop them at the border, yet requires us to pay billions to take care of them.
The polls, Matt Barreto, were, at first, Prop 187, it was like almost a 2-to-1 margin, right? And then it got really close. People started getting the gist of what it was about. There were a lot of protests. It did win, and Pete Wilson won re-election. 187 actually passed overwhelmingly, 59-41%. And it wasn't just Republicans that voted for that, right?
That's right. I mean, early on, there was not a lot of information about Prop 187. And as the Wilson campaign itself got closer, he leaned into this issue, and he's the one that brought more attention to it, both good and bad. So it clarified the issue. The opponents were really able to use it, start the protest movement, et cetera. But at that time, it did have also Democratic and independent support. Now, today, we live in a world where immigration is super polarized along partisan lines. Democrats are almost lockstep in with the Dreamers and the immigration reform advocates. But that's not what was happening in California back in 1994. Yes, it was Republican-led. Yes, it was led by Ron Prince and others in Orange County. But it had independent and Democratic support. People thought that there was some sort of immigration issue, a problem that needed to be solved. And that's why you saw it get 59% support.
Matt, things have obviously shifted here in California since 1994. There's been this, you could call it a sea change in the perspective on undocumented immigrants across the state. There's been a sea change in politics, too, nationwide. So talk a little bit about that change and the role that Prop 187 played. How did it bring this change on?
Well, the first thing that happened in California was the simple demographic changes that were taking place. So the population was already changing demographically in our state. And between 1994 and 2004, the Latino population increased by 2.8 million. The Asian American population increased by about 900,000. And so there you have almost 4 million there just in those two communities. The white non-Hispanic population increased by less than 200,000. In those 10 years. So 4 million more from the immigrant communities, and the white population basically is unchanged. Now, coupled with the population change is the voting demographic change. And that is that we had an additional 1.2 million more Latino registered voters and 400,000 more Asian American registered voters. And again, the white registered voter population changed by only 160,000. So suddenly, California, in reaction to Prop 187, had many, many more immigrants as registered voters and as voters. And they started sending a message to politicians that this was our America, this is our community, and we're not going to stand for this. And that started to spread. People in California started to become more acquainted with immigrants, regardless of immigration status. They started to have a more positive outlook. You started to see the state legislature, after term limits went into effect, get much more diverse. And as that happened, it started to spread to other places. In many ways, that California has been a laboratory for public policy.
Is it accurate, Gustavo, to say what happened in California in 1994 is now happening in America in 2019, 25 years later? I mean, it's not Governor Pete Wilson in a proposition. It's now a president and Donald J. Trump leading the charge.
Yeah, you could draw a straight line from 187 all the way to Trump in the White House. What you see with Trump is exactly what Wilson did 25 years ago, except on a far bigger, far more prominent, and I would argue far uglier level.
Matt, if the current policies of the federal government echo what happened in 1994, then do you think there could be a similar political shift nationally?
I think we're already starting to see that pendulum swing. And people have to remember, you opened the segment by saying that Prop 187 passed with 59%. Pete Wilson was elected, reelected as governor. And so it was successful here. And people thought, hey, that was the right move. Republicans did. They said, we won on our issues. But what happened was it sprung this backlash. And in California, it took about 10 years or so. But we're already seeing that happen in other places. So Arizona is the place that we study a lot and look at because they had their own Prop 187 with SB 1070, the Show Me Your Papers law that was passed in 2010. So if you go from 2010, they won. Jan Brewer was reelected as governor using that SB 1070 to stand on. But since then, you've seen Joe Arpaio recalled from office, lost a reelection. And you've now seen Kristen Sinema, a Democrat, elected to the U.S. Senate in 2018. So even quicker, a quicker acceleration in Arizona than we saw in California. And now people are talking about upwards of 7 House seats up for grabs in Texas.
Do you guys think that this action, you know, wanting to put the citizenship question on the census form, you have, I mean, almost like there's some sort of punishment if you are to get engaged in civic life. Do you think that stops the Latino community, whether you're documented or not? You probably know someone who's not documented, right? And you don't want to get in trouble.
Right. So we sort of see it as having two possible effects. On the one side, if there is just a very authoritarian and draconian crackdown, it is going to have a repressive effect. People are going to withdraw. But we're also seeing a sort of spurring people to mobilization, a fighting back. Now, at the same time, if they are instituting ICE raids across the country and then asking you to fill out your citizenship status on the census at the same time, these things are certain to have what's called a chilling effect in the social science literature. That is, you sort of pull yourself out of that position. You say, I've got ICE raids going on in my county. Now the federal government is distributing forms asking me to list the names of everyone who lives in my house and their immigration status. So
it's going to make you less likely to vote. It's going to make you less likely to do anything.
That's exactly right. And this is calculated. And they know that. And that's why I think you're going to see when the census drops, even though the citizenship question isn't on there, when the census drops, you're going to probably see an uptick in ICE raids and that sort of immigration enforcement to remind people of what's at stake. And that's really scary.
Gustavo?
On the other hand, if when Latinos are faced with an existential crisis, with meaning that they want people, the federal government or politicians want them out of here, they're going to fight back. They're going to fight back, whether with votes, whether with walkouts, whether with protests or chants or whatever. And you saw that with 187. Part of the story of 187 was these high school walkouts where tens of thousands of high school students for a good 2 weeks walked out all across California because they, for an entire year, they heard that 187, people like themselves and their children were ruining California. And they said, enough's enough. And even if that was the only political form of activism those students did their entire lives, I talked to so many people who said, yeah, 187 was what woke me up. 187 made me go into college. 187 made me become a politician. 187 just made me a business person. So, beware those people who take that template of 187 and try to win elections in the short run. It's really a Pyrrhic victory. And if you don't believe me, look at the California state legislature right now. Blue, 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 blue.
Gustavo Arellano writes for the LA Times. Check out his upcoming podcast. By the way, it's called This Is California, The Battle of 187. Gustavo, thanks.
Gracias.
Matt Barreto, professor of political science and Chicano studies over at UCLA. Matt, thank you for your time.
You got it, Steve. It's my pleasure.
That's going to do it for us today. An update on the Getty fire right now at about 618 acres burned. A few structures, under a dozen structures burned as well. Zero containment at this hour. Firefighters hoping to get, hopefully, a handle on it this afternoon. Tomorrow, access to the coast. It's the thrust of a commission that has a lot of power. But how much power? Are they using that power? It's The Business with Kim Masters next. We're online at kcrw.com/greaterLA. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for the ear and for your time. Have a great day.